Welcome to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring the random prompts of Daniel Rosehill as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters. Join us for deep dives into AI, technology, and whatever other random thing Daniel finds fascinating today. Subscribe on Spotify or your favorite podcatcher. Now, today's episode.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hi there, Herman and Corin. So we have made a few episodes to date about the geopolitics of the Middle East. And I think that if we manage to make, I think probably 20 episodes about fiber optic cable and submarine cables, we could probably stretch to 200 about just the beginnings of this conflict and kind of only be scratching the surface. But one of the most interesting aspects that has always kind of perplexed me when reading the news about this region is Hamas's web of influence in different countries here. Hamas, the organization behind October 7th, you know, terrorist organization, certainly according to Israel, and I think according to most Western democracies, hardline committed to the destruction of Israel, born out of Gaza, but seems to have a cozy relationship with Turkey and with Qatar. With Qatar, it's unclear. I mean, what I really mean is it's unclear to me, maybe also to a lot of other people, but I never quite get these kind of second level connections with other countries seem to be peripherally involved. So Qatar hosts some of Hamas's leaders in exile who reportedly live a life of you know, opulence there, in stark contrast to the people in Gaza. And is also well known as the where Al Jazeera is broadcasting from, which Israel has taken a stronger stance against in recent years. Hamas also has operations in Syria and Turkey. Turkey in particular is often described in the media as being home to the Hamas Politburo, whatever that means. And I think I know what it means, the political function of Hamas, but I never quite understand what that means pragmatically speaking, because we're talking about a movement that is both a paramilitary force and a de facto government in Gaza, whether people like that fact or not. And its operations abroad are murky, but it does seem that Turkey or Turkey seems to tolerate and even kind of embrace them. And Turkey's relationship with Israel is itself kind of perplexing, but I think that's pretty established as facts go, that Syria, Turkey, and Qatar have all been facilitating Hamas. But that's only the start of the Hamas's spread around the world. When the latest flotilla that attempted to break Israel's siege on the Gaza Strip reached here, there was investigative pieces and information put out by Israel showing that Hamas operatives in Europe were involved in the coordination of that, and really a murky world of cryptocurrency transfers, charities that sometimes were operating as fronts for Hamas. So the picture that builds up is not one of a isolated paramilitary extremist force just operating in the Gaza Strip, but one of a regional power of sorts that has operations in major neighboring Arab states, and if not exactly embassies and a global spy network, something almost kind of approaching that, maybe sleeper cells or operatives or whatever word you want to use, involved in funding activities and maybe other activities abroad. So that's what I'd love to get into today, Herman and Corin. We delve once more into murky territory here. But why exactly is it that these other Arab states have, and specific ones seem to have, developed a close relationship with Hamas? And how does that even work when you have an organization like this, or the IRGC for that matter, that is prescribed and legal in Europe? But nevertheless, these groups do seem to have networks stretching throughout the continent, and other continents, often involved in fundraising, front companies, the whole repertoire of methods used, let's say, in modern warfare, overt and clandestine. Herman and Corin, let's talk about the regional influence of Hamas in today's episode of My Weird Prompts.
Hey everyone, welcome back to My Weird Prompts. I am Corin, and I am sitting here with my brother and our favorite resident expert,
Herman Poppleberry, at your service. It is great to be back. We are a bit of a strange trio, aren't we? A man, a sloth, and a donkey, according to our website bio, just trying to make sense of a very complicated world from our home here.
It does sound like the start of a joke, but the topics we tackle are anything but. Today, we have a deep one. Our housemate Daniel sent us a prompt that is honestly one of the most complex geopolitical puzzles in the Middle East right now. He wants to know about the international web of influence that Hamas maintains.
It is a massive topic, Corin. People often think of Hamas as just being confined to the Gaza Strip, but they actually operate as this hybrid entity. They are a paramilitary force, a de facto government, and an international political movement all at once.
Right. And Daniel specifically asked about their relationships with countries like Turkey, Qatar, and Syria. How does an organization that is labeled as a terrorist group by the United States and the European Union manage to keep offices in major world capitals and run a multi-million dollar financial network?
That is the heart of the mystery. We are going to look at the pragmatic reasons why these states facilitate them and how these global networks actually function on the ground. It is about leverage, diplomacy, and a whole lot of gray market finance.
Well, let's start with the most visible part of this web, which is the political office in Qatar. For years, we have seen high-level Hamas leaders like Ismail Haniyeh and Khaled Mashal living in Doha. To a lot of people, that seems incredibly contradictory. Qatar is a major non-North Atlantic Treaty Organization ally of the United States and hosts a massive American airbase at Al Udeid. So, how does that work?
It is the ultimate balancing act. Qatar has carved out a niche for itself as the regional mediator. They basically told the world, look, if you want someone to talk to the groups that no one else can talk to, we will be the ones to host them. The United States has actually encouraged this at various points because they need a channel to negotiate things like hostage releases or ceasefires.
So it is a bit of a keep your friends close and your enemies closer situation for the international community?
Exactly. If the Hamas leadership was in Tehran or hidden in a bunker in Gaza, there would be no way to pass messages. By having them in Doha, they are accessible. But for Hamas, it provides something even more valuable, legitimacy and safety. They can hold press conferences, meet with foreign diplomats, and operate with a level of prestige that they simply could not get anywhere else.
But what about the lifestyle? Daniel mentioned the reports of leaders living in opulence while Gaza is in ruins. Does that affect their influence?
It is a major point of friction. There is a clear divide between the outside leadership in Doha and the inside leadership in Gaza, like Yahya Sinwar. The outside leaders are the diplomats and the money men. They maintain the international relationships that keep the movement from being completely isolated.
That brings us to Turkey. Now, Turkey is a North Atlantic Treaty Organization member, but their relationship with Hamas feels very different from Qatar's. It seems more ideological.
You are spot on. President Erdogan and his Justice and Development Party, or AKP, share deep ideological roots with the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the movement Hamas grew out of. Erdogan has famously referred to Hamas as a national liberation group rather than a terrorist organization.
And that has real-world consequences for how they operate there, right? It is not just the diplomatic office.
No, it is much more functional. Turkey has become a hub for Hamas's financial and logistical operations. For years, the United States Treasury Department has been flagging individuals and companies based in Turkey that are allegedly part of the Hamas investment portfolio. We are talking about real estate companies, construction firms, and money exchange houses.
Wait, so they are actually running legitimate businesses on the Turkish Stock Exchange?
There have been significant allegations regarding that. For example, the United States sanctioned a company called TrendGYO, a real estate investment trust based in Istanbul. The Treasury Department claimed it was part of a secret Hamas investment portfolio worth hundreds of millions of dollars. Turkey, however, does not recognize Hamas as a terrorist group, so these companies can often operate legally within the Turkish system.
That is fascinating. It is like they have a diversified stock portfolio to fund a war. But how do they move that money back to Gaza, or use it for their operations when the banking system is so heavily monitored?
That is where the clandestine part of Daniel's prompt comes in. They use a mix of traditional banking, shell companies, and the hawala system. Hawala is an informal method of transferring money based on a huge network of brokers. It is almost impossible to track because no physical money actually crosses borders in the moment. It is all based on trust and balancing ledgers between brokers in different cities.
So a broker in Istanbul gets cash, and a broker in Gaza pays out the equivalent amount, and they settle the debt later through trade or other means.
Precisely. And in recent years, they have also moved into cryptocurrency. While it is a common misconception that crypto is totally anonymous, it does allow them to bypass traditional bank filters for a short time. They have used a network of exchanges and digital wallets to move millions, though international authorities have become much better at tracking these blockchain transactions.
It sounds like they have built a parallel economy. But let's look at Syria for a moment. That relationship has been a bit of a roller coaster, hasn't it?
It really has. Before 2011, Hamas's main headquarters was actually in Damascus. They were part of the Axis of Resistance, along with Iran and Hezbollah. But when the Syrian civil war broke out, Hamas made a choice that nearly destroyed those ties. They supported the mostly Sunni rebels against Bashar al-Assad's regime.
Because Hamas is a Sunni organization, and Assad is Alawite, backed by Shia Iran.
Right. It was an ideological and sectarian split. Assad kicked them out, and Iran cut their funding significantly for a few years. But in the last few years, we have seen a major reconciliation. Hamas realized they could not survive without the Axis of Resistance for military support, and Assad realized that having Hamas back in his camp helped restore his image as a champion of the Palestinian cause.
So it is a marriage of convenience now?
Totally. They officially restored ties in late 2022, marking a significant shift in their regional alignment that has continued to develop through 2025 and 2026. Now, Syria serves as a transit point and a place for coordination with Hezbollah and Iranian officials. It is less about the political and more about the paramilitary side of their operations.
I want to push on something Daniel asked about, the clandestine activities in Europe. If Hamas is banned in the United Kingdom, Germany, and most of the European Union, how are they still operating there?
This is where it gets really murky. In Europe, Hamas does not usually operate under the name Hamas. They work through what intelligence agencies call front organizations. These are often charities, cultural centers, or advocacy groups that appear to be focused on Palestinian humanitarian relief or political activism.
So the average person donating to a relief fund might not even know where the money is going?
Sometimes that is the case. Other times, the organizations are used to spread the movement's ideology or to recruit. For example, several countries have investigated groups for providing material support to Hamas. The challenge for European police is proving that the money is actually going to the armed wing, the Izz ad-Din al-Qassam brigades, rather than just to a hospital or a school in Gaza.
Because Hamas is the government in Gaza, the line between humanitarian aid and government funding is almost non-existent, right?
That is exactly the problem. If you fund a school in Gaza, you are essentially freeing up Hamas's own budget to spend more on rockets or tunnels. It is a concept called fungibility of funds. European authorities have intensified enforcement since October 2023, with ongoing crackdowns continuing through 2025 and into 2026. We have seen bans on certain organizations and more aggressive monitoring of financial flows in places like Germany and the Netherlands.
You mentioned the Dutch and German authorities. Is there a specific reason why those countries are hubs?
They have large Palestinian and broader Arab diaspora communities. Most people in those communities are just trying to live their lives, but it provides a sea for the fish to swim in, to use a counterinsurgency metaphor. It makes it easier for operatives to blend in and move money or organize events without drawing immediate attention.
Okay, let's step back and look at the why for these host countries. We talked about Qatar wanting to be a mediator and Turkey's ideological ties. But what is the long-term goal for them? Why take the risk of hosting a group that the world superpower calls terrorists?
It is all about leverage, Korn. For Qatar, hosting Hamas is a get-out-of-jail-free card in regional diplomacy. When a crisis hits, everyone from Washington to Jerusalem has to call Doha. That gives a tiny country like Qatar an outsized influence on the world stage. It is a form of soft power mixed with hard diplomacy.
And for Turkey?
For Erdogan, it is partly about domestic politics. Being a champion of the Palestinian cause plays very well with his conservative religious base. But it is also about Turkey's ambition to be the leader of the Sunni Muslim world. By hosting Hamas, they are positioning themselves as a more authentic representative of Islamic interests than, say, Saudi Arabia or Egypt.
It seems like Hamas is a pawn in a much larger game between these regional powers.
They are a pawn, but they are also a player. They know exactly how to play these countries off each other. If Qatar puts too much pressure on them to moderate, they lean closer to Turkey. If Turkey gets too cozy with Israel, they run back to Iran and Syria. They are masters of using their hybrid nature to find whatever crack in the international system is available.
That is a great way to put it, finding the cracks. But how does this stay pragmatic when they are illegal in so many places? Daniel asked how these networks function despite the bans.
It functions through what I call legal arbitrage. They look for jurisdictions with different rules. If the United States freezes their assets, they move them to a Turkish bank. If Germany bans a specific charity, they set up a new one with a different name and a slightly different mission statement. It is a constant game of cat and mouse.
Does the international community have any way to actually stop this? Or is it just too decentralized?
It is incredibly difficult because of the state sponsors. As long as countries like Turkey and Qatar provide a safe haven, you can't just shut down Hamas. You can squeeze their finances, you can arrest individual operatives in Europe, but the core of the organization remains protected by the sovereign borders of other nations.
It feels like a massive failure of the international legal system. If we all agree that certain actions are terrorism, but we can't agree on who is a terrorist because of national interests, then the labels almost become meaningless.
That is the cynical view, and it is hard to argue with. The definition of terrorist often stops at the border of a country's national interest. To the United States, they are terrorists. To Iran, they are the vanguard of a revolution. To Turkey, they are a political party. Hamas thrives in that disagreement.
Let's talk about the second-order effects of this. When Hamas uses these international networks, what does it do to the Palestinian cause as a whole? Does it help or hurt the push for a state?
That is a deeply divisive question. Supporters would say that without these international links, the Palestinian cause would be forgotten and Gaza would be completely silenced. But critics, including many Palestinians in the West Bank and the diaspora, argue that Hamas's international web actually undermines Palestinian legitimacy.
Because it ties the movement to regional power struggles and extremist ideologies.
Right. It makes the Palestinian struggle look like a proxy war for Iran or a tool for Erdogan's ambitions. It also creates a massive rift within Palestinian politics. You have the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah trying to work through the United Nations and traditional diplomacy, while Hamas is running this shadow international network. It makes it almost impossible to have a unified Palestinian voice.
And what about the people in Gaza? Do they see any of this international influence in their daily lives? Or is it all just for the leadership?
They see the results of the funding, for better or worse. They see the social services, the schools, and the mosques that Hamas funds through these networks. But they also see the consequences of the paramilitary side, the wars and the blockades that are triggered by Hamas's actions. There is a lot of resentment about the leaders living safely in Doha while the people in Gaza bear the brunt of the conflict.
It is a heartbreaking dynamic. We are talking about billions of dollars moving through these networks over the years. Where does most of that money actually come from? Is it all state-sponsored?
State sponsorship from Iran is the biggest chunk, especially for the military side. Iran has historically provided upwards of $100 million a year. But the investment portfolio we talked about in Turkey and other places is also huge. Then you have taxes. They collect on goods coming into Gaza. And finally, the individual donations from around the world.
So it is a diversified revenue model. They aren't dependent on just one source.
Exactly. That is why they are so resilient. If Iran cuts them off, they have the businesses. If the businesses are sanctioned, they have the charities. It is a very sophisticated financial architecture.
I'm curious about the role of the housemate who sent the prompt, Daniel. He asked about the clandestine activities. Beyond money, what else are they doing? Are we talking about intelligence gathering?
Absolutely. They have a very active intelligence wing that operates abroad. They monitor Israeli targets, they try to recruit people with access to technology or information, and they engage in cyber warfare. There have been several cases where Hamas was caught trying to hack the phones of Israeli soldiers using fake profiles on social media.
So, it is a full-spectrum operation. They have a foreign ministry, a finance ministry, and an intelligence agency, all operating without a formal state.
That is the best way to think of it. They are a state in exile and a state in waiting at the same time. And the states that facilitate them do so because it gives them a seat at one of the most important tables in global politics.
It is a sobering look at how the world actually works versus how we want it to work. The rules and the bans only go so far when there is a pragmatic reason to break them.
It really is. It is a reminder that in geopolitics, morality is often a luxury that states feel they can't afford. They look at the map and they see tools. Hamas is a very sharp, very dangerous tool that several countries believe they can use to their advantage.
Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground here. We've looked at the diplomatic cover in Qatar, the financial hub in Turkey, the military coordination in Syria, and the murky world of front organizations in Europe.
It is a lot to digest, and the situation is constantly evolving. As we speak, new sanctions are being drafted and new back-channel negotiations are happening in those very same cities.
Before we wrap up, I want to make sure we give people some practical takeaways. If you're reading the news about this, what should you be looking for to see where this web is going next?
I would watch two things. First, watch the relationship between Turkey and Israel. Whenever they try to normalize ties, Hamas's presence in Turkey becomes a major sticking point. If Turkey starts expelling Hamas leaders, you know the pressure is working. Second, watch the money. The more the world moves toward transparent digital banking, the harder it gets for these shadow networks to function.
That is great advice. And for our listeners, if you want to dive deeper into some of the historical context of these regional players, you can always check out our website at myweirdprompts.com. We have a searchable archive of over 200 episodes covering everything from the history of the Muslim Brotherhood to the mechanics of modern sanctions.
Yeah, we have been at this for a long time. If you have questions about a specific country we mentioned today, chances are we have an episode that goes even deeper into their specific foreign policy.
And if you're enjoying the show, please take a moment to leave us a review on Spotify or whatever podcast app you're using. It really does help other people find these deep dives.
It genuinely makes a difference. We are just a man, a sloth, and a donkey trying to make sense of the world, and we appreciate every one of you who joins us for the ride.
Thanks to our housemate Daniel for sending in this prompt. It was a tough one, but a necessary one to understand the reality of the Middle East today.
Absolutely. Thanks for the challenge, Daniel.
All right, that's it for this episode of My Weird Prompts. We'll be back soon with another deep dive into the strange and complex questions you send our way.
Until next time, keep asking the weird questions.
Bye, everyone.
Take care.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox Turbo.
Thanks for listening to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring Daniel Rosehill's AI prompts, as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters including me, Cornelius the Sloth. Subscribe on Spotify or visit myweirdprompts.com.